You're listening to HuntertonChamberRadio.com, sponsored by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. Our studios are located in the CenturyLink building at 14 Mine Street, Flemington, New Jersey. The content and views of our hosts do not necessarily reflect the views of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. To contact our station, call 908-782-7115 or email onair@hunterdon-chamber.org. Thank you to our sponsors and underwriters. Please remember to support them and buy Hunterdon, buy local. Visit www.hunterdonchamberradio.com for a complete listing of our programming. Stepping into stockings, stepping into shoes, dipping in the pocket of her raincoat. It's just another day. It's just another day. It's just another day.
She is really my go-to person for so many areas of family law. And certainly she is the person who has been teaching all of us in New Jersey when the civil union statute was proposed, when it was passed, when the marriage statute in New Jersey, she was the one to show us how to do these things, how to deal with them, and where there still are problems. And so we'll be talking to Deb, and my second guest today is William Singer. He's a partner in Singer and Fedden, and locally he's in Bellmead, so he's one of our neighbors, and he's been practicing for many, many years, and he probably about as many as I have, right, Bill? And Bill has received many awards, and he was... in fact, he's received the Bill of Rights Award from the American Civil Liberties Union, and that's the first ever Lifetime Achievement Award. And from the Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender section of the New Jersey Bar Association, and the Presidential Award from the New Jersey Association for Justice. And he has been named, both Deb and Bill have been named as super lawyers by the New Jersey Super Lawyers magazine. Frankly, for most people, I'm not so sure that means much, but for these two, it does. And Bill received his BA with distinction from Rutgers, and his JD from Columbia University. And so I welcome both of you today.
Thank you for inviting us.
And thanks, I spent a whole program a few weeks ago on the day that the case came down from the Supreme Court, that it was decided on June 26, 2015. I spent the day talking about the case in general. But I think I'd like perhaps you each to make some comment on the case. And then I think one of the questions that people have are, you know, does this case solve all the problems? And we know that New Jersey recognized marriage and civil unions, so that probably more importantly, what are the continuing problems in New Jersey? So, Deb?
So, Pat, I wanted to start off by saying that one of the most important things about this Supreme Court case is that it talks about two really essential parts of our Constitution. And the first, and they're both contained within the 14th Amendment. And it talks about the right to marry as being both a due process right, meaning that the state owes people the opportunity to fully express themselves and to act in as they feel is best for themselves without interference from the state. And that it is also an equal protection right, so that same-sex couples have the exact same right to make the exact same choices for themselves as do different-sex couples. The equal protection part of this is really important, and this goes to Pat's question about what are some of the problems that remain. One of the biggest problems that we have nationally, and I'll talk about why it really isn't as important here in New Jersey, but nationally, there are very few states that provide protection for gay people in the arenas of employment, housing, and access to public accommodations, things like hotels, shopping opportunities, access to public venues. So in New Jersey, we have a law against discrimination that gives protection to people based on both sexual orientation and gender identity and expression in those very areas. And we've already, in our past, litigated some of those issues. So the good news for gay and lesbian people in New Jersey is that while this marriage case deals with equal protection, our laws here in New Jersey provide for the enforcement of people's rights in those public venues. The good thing about the equal protection decision on a national level is that I think it gives lawyers around the country an opportunity to really look at places where people are discriminated against and have no means of addressing that discrimination. So while it's a bad thing that there's a lot of discrimination out there in housing and employment, I think this case opens the door for a lot of good potential future resolutions of those matters.
Bill.
So I think one of the wonderful things about the case is it affirms that same-sex couples and their families are part of the American family. And that I think the gravity of the case is such that people around the country now look at lesbian, gay families differently than they did before, as equal, and are recognizing them as equal. And so that has a very strong impact. At the same time, there is a feeling that now all equality has been achieved. And as Deb pointed out, there isn't all equality. You can get married at noon and be fired at 2. And there are cases like this already happening around the country where people who have gotten married have been fired or lost their housing when a landlord found out they were gay because there's no protection. Another thing that is really key is marriage equality does not equal parentage equality. And a lot of people, particularly in the lesbian and gay community, feel, well, now both of our names will be put on a birth certificate if one of us has a child, and we don't have to really worry about the rights of the non-biological parent, and that's not true.
And I think that, and I don't mean to interrupt,
that's
but
okay.
I think that is one of the real concerns. Certainly as attorneys, we had seen this in the past where in the adoption arena, both for men and women, and part of the problem around the country is that in most cases, if someone adopts a child, before that happens, the biological parents' rights have to be terminated. So that has created a lot of problems. Is that problem going to be solved at all with this new case?
Not really. And I think we have to remember that most of the law that governs who is a parent and who is not a parent is very old law, and it's based on our understanding of what biology is all about. It's not really based on the reality of how modern people, both gay, lesbian, and straight, form their families, how they parent children, and how they get together and sometimes forms groups of people who support children, and those children end up with parental relationships with several people. So in the adoption arena, the big issue that has been resolved is that there are a number of states around the country, like Michigan, and there was one of the cases that was heard by the Supreme Court was an adoption case. Michigan says that anybody can individually adopt a child, whether you're gay or straight, but if you're going to have a joint adoption, in other words, form a legal relationship with two parents to a child, that the couple has to be married. And that case, in the Michigan case, two women wanted to raise a family together. They adopted children, some through the foster system. Some of them were special needs kids. But they found that they couldn't do it together. So they individually had to adopt those children. And when they went to the judge and said, we want to adopt each other's children, the judge said, well, Michigan law doesn't allow that. You're not married. And they said, well, we can't get married in Michigan. And the judge said, I know. And so the judge actually asked them to amend their complaint, to bring the issue of marriage into their adoption complaint. And so for those states that restrict joint adoptions to married couples, now gay and lesbian couples have the opportunity to right that wrong by being married.
And will that make it automatic? In other words, let's assume right now that there are couples, even in New Jersey, and my husband and I, one of our children was adopted. He was adopted when he was older. And immediately, as soon as the adoption papers were signed, one of the things that we were able to do was put him on our medical insurance. And I know that's been a real problem in cases where one spouse or one partner had medical insurance and they couldn't mm-hmm. cover everyone. So is the fact that someone gets married now, What happens? In other words, is it going to be automatic, or are they still going to have to go through an adoption? In other words, let's assume that it is a two gay women. One had a child prior to the marriage. What's going to happen? What do they have to do?
If they got married subsequently to the birth of the child, the marriage makes the second parent a step-parent, but does not make them a full legal parent. They have actually no legal rights as a step-parent. So that in that case, the second parent would have to do an adoption. But even more confusing, I think, is the situation where you have a married same-sex couple in New Jersey, and one of them, through artificial insemination, gets pregnant and gives birth. Right now, the Bureau of Vital Statistics in New Jersey will put both women's name on the birth certificate as parents.
Okay.
And that leads them to believe that they are parents. But actually, a birth certificate is only indicia of parentage. It's not proof of parentage. And the
can you explain that? Because I think you're absolutely right. I would assume that if two people, their names on the birth certificate, and frankly, we won't get into it, but we know what happens with two unmarried heterosexual couples. If they're both on the birth certificate, there's a... You know,
but
they're both parents.
That's only done by a marital presumption, which is based on a biological assumption that the spouse of the woman who gave birth is the biological parent.
Mm-hmm. So let's think about it. The best illustration, really, Pat, as you're suggesting, might be a man and a woman who are not married, and she gets pregnant. And she says she's in the hospital. She gets a form put in front of her, and it says, who's the father? And she puts down Joe's name. Now, that's a record. She's creating that record. She's asking the state of New Jersey to accept her statement that Joe is the father of this child. And New Jersey accepts that and places Joe's name on the birth certificate. Joe may not be the father of that child, and maybe a couple of weeks down the line, John says, wait a minute, I think that's my kid. And he asks for a paternity test, and it turns out that John is the father of that child. So the birth certificate is a record. It's created by individuals. It's accepted, at least on its face value, by the state as being the truth. But it is not. It is a presumption, and it is what we call a rebuttable presumption, meaning that other facts may come into the matter later on that cause you to come into doubt or that, in fact, prove that what is on that birth certificate is not the truth. So in the context of a gay couple, a lot of times Bill and I have seen litigation where two women are together. One of them has a baby. She puts her partner's or spouse's name on the birth certificate and then later on comes back and says, you know what, I didn't know what I was doing. I did it just to get insurance. I really didn't mean for her to be an equal parent with me. And now they have a dispute about who the real parent is. And so that again says that the birth certificate is not something that is the end-all and be-all to tell us who a parent is.
Right, and the only way really for the non-biological parent to protect her or himself is to do an adoption or get a parentage order, which says then they are legally recognized by a court to be a full parent, and that order is subject under the United States Constitution to full faith and credit in every state. And if someone questions the non-biological parent's legal parentage, you bring out the order. And also with people traveling from state to state and also out of the country, it really becomes more necessary to have that paperwork to prove that you are the parent. You might end up in a country that doesn't really recognize same-sex marriage and looks oddly at it. And to say, well, my name is on this birth certificate because I'm married to this woman, when they don't recognize your marriage, could put you in real jeopardy and put the child in jeopardy.
So what I'm hearing is what you're saying basically is, you know, don't just assume because you're married and your name goes on a birth certificate, you should not take that next step and go through the adoption.
Absolutely.
Do people know this? I mean, this is really significant.
That's why we're running
a program to get that word out. And you're right. I mean, at every advance here in New Jersey and around the country, for the rights of gay and lesbian couples to enter into legal relationships, there has been a false sense of security that those adult relationships have something to do with their relationships to their children. And I think if we just look at it and remember that marriage is an adult relationship, and it doesn't necessarily, it has an impact on how children are treated, but it is not meant to solely deal with children. It is meant to deal with the rights and obligations of the adults in the relationship.
And I think what you're saying, though, is absolutely the non-biological parent must seek that protection, because otherwise, I've been in court. Most of us attorneys, or many attorneys, have been in court when, in fact, there's a divorce between a same-sex couple. And I have heard over and over and over again the attorney for the biological mother arguing that she has superior rights because she's the biological mother. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, some of that might just be prejudice, but I mean, the point is we have to be sure in these instances that everyone knows what their rights are. And I think that's one of the reasons I wanted to have this conversation, because I don't think people do.
But once that adoption is complete, once the parents are equal.
Absolutely.
Right? There's no, absolutely. Edge for the bio parent.
Well, right. And as it should be. Right. I mean, you know, that's as it should be. But I think that...
Now, I do think, I mean, we've seen some instances around the state where your comment, Pat, about prejudice, I think is, and it may not be prejudice outrightly, so it may be ignorance as well. I mean, we've seen some instances where gay couples have children and they have done their adoptions. They each recognize the other as being an equal parent to the child. And yet, if there is a custodial dispute in court, we've seen some mediation problems. We've seen other issues where people say, well, doesn't a child bond more fully with the biological parent? And it's the same argument that always used to be made about, doesn't the child bond more with mother than with father? Mm-hmm. And we have, for a very long time in New Jersey, gotten rid of this notion. They called it the tender years doctrine, that children were better bonded to their mothers than their fathers. And we've tried our best to kick our way out of that box so that we recognize that fathers have an equal ability to parent and to parent well, and need to be given an opportunity to do so. But we're still having that kind of prejudice, I think, within particularly lesbian families where the child has been carried by one of them.
And I agree with you. And I, to some extent, because my husband Dave and I have two biological children and we adopted the third. And there is some sense out there, because we'll hear it from people, oh, which one is the adopted one? As if that makes a difference.
Right, right.
It happened to one of our biological children and one of our adopted. They look more alike than the other. So, you know, people, I mean, I was shocked at first when people would say that. Oh, which one is the adopted one? And obviously you could get this sense that they didn't think that was quite the same. And we just have to be sure that it is in the courts and that there will be, you know, that judges and everyone else is educated, because I know that, you know, I can even see that in our situation, so I can certainly imagine that's going to be a concern that the non-biological parent would have, especially when two people really talk about what makes sense in that family as to perhaps which woman should become pregnant and carry the child. I mean, that, you know, that is a discussion that, you know, you don't have in a normal situation, not normal, but in a situation where you have a man and a woman, you know, we know who's going to carry the child. So I know that very often there are a lot of discussions as to, you know, perhaps one has a career that's going to make more sense for that woman not to have and not to be the biological mother. But what other issues do you think that people need to know about with respect to children? Anything? I mean, once the adoption takes place, And in New Jersey, and I'm not sure which state, but I know that some states did require termination of parental rights in order for there to be an adoption. But that has not been a problem in New Jersey for many years, has it?
Right. That doesn't happen anymore. It did originally when Deb and I started doing these adoptions in the early 1990s. We had the bio mother had to terminate her rights, and then the court would allow both the bio and the non-bio parent mothers to adopt, which was very hard to explain to our clients, and they had a very hard time with it. Eventually, the courts changed that and didn't make that a requirement.
Well, I think that was also a problem, as I remember, if two men wanted to adopt, and, you know, were they able to adopt one child? And I know this was a Michigan case.
Right, right.
I don't think it made any difference whether it was a woman or a man.
Yeah,
in
no,
that
the
case.
Real issue in New Jersey always was that the only type of adoption where you didn't have to terminate one of the parents' rights was a step-parent adoption. And until we, lawyers like me and Bill and a few others around the state, were able to convince the courts that gay couples should be treated as if they were married and should the second parent should be looked at as being a step-parent, did the courts start and making that analogy? And then they said, well, yeah, this is really more like a step-parent adoption than it is a private adoption or some other format. So, you know, it's been an evolution. But I really think, you know, Bill and I worked very hard in the early 90s. But frankly, I think I was pleasantly surprised and remain somewhat amazed that we were able to accomplish what we were with the assistance of judges, and that there were very few that I met at that time who weren't really along for the ride and said, and were saying to us, how can we do this? You know, let's figure it out. You know, there were a couple that were difficult, mm-hmm. And that actually created the cases that are reported that tell us, yeah, we can do this and you have to do this. But for the most part, I was pleasantly surprised and remain so.
Well, and anyone who's interested in the Supreme Court case should read a little bit more about the two women, the Michigan, because Michigan was against the adoption by the two women. And as I said, not only were they were adopting children out of the foster, as Deb said, mm-hmm. out of the foster system, and they were adopting children that were considered unadoptable.
Right.
And yet they had problems with the courts. I mean, you'd think that the courts would have been, you know, saying, here, step up. What can we do to help you to achieve this? Because the focus never seemed, at least in the Michigan case and maybe a few others, the focus never seemed on the children. I mean, that needs to be the real focus.
Well, I think one of the interesting things about this Supreme Court case is Justice Kennedy, who wrote the majority opinion, has spent a lot of time talking about children. He did in the Windsor case also that provided federal recognition right. of same-sex marriages. He was very concerned about children being with their parents and perceiving that their parents had lesser status than other children's parents. And in fact, by the time we got to this Obergefell case, I think even some of the most conservative of the justices were respectful of children's place in the world and of how their parents did have some significant disabilities as a result of not being able to marry. It didn't mean that it necessarily swayed the day for those four justices who were in the dissent, but I think there was at least a respectful tone when discussing children, and they've gotten away from all of the arguments that gay parents make bad parents, that children are better off, you know, if they have one dad and one mom and they happen to be the biological parents. I think there's a recognition that families are very different and that parents of every kind and in every configuration have an ability to raise children well.
I think what, you know, Deb says is absolutely true, but it's that type of language that Justice Kennedy used in the Obergefell decision that confuses people to think that, well, because they respect lesbian and gay families, then our family must be protected by this decision. When really the parent, the non-biological parent, is not protected, despite that wonderful language by Justice Kennedy, and the non-biological parent has to do something to get protection.
And that really needs to go out there, and people need to know that. I have not seen any articles saying those things. I know you're going to be putting on some programs for lawyers, but how do we get that information? Hopefully people will listen to this. But what other information? I mean, specifically, let's assume that I came in to see one of you, and I've just married, and at this point, if I had just married my spouse and she had a child, what would you tell me to do in that case? Let's assume I've just married, she had a biological child, and at this point I had not adopted. I guess that's an easy answer.
Right, that you have to adopt. The issue, particularly getting the word out, is that so many young people now, lesbian and gay couples, want to have families. And not everyone has access to the expensive medical care you need to do assisted reproductive technology, artificial insemination. So people are getting donors off of Craigslist or a friend of a friend, not realizing the legal implications of that. Because if you use a donor off of Craigslist or a friend of a friend, that person is going to be considered that donor is really considered a parent until their rights are terminated.
And in fact, you know, it would backfire for both people. It could backfire for both people because let's say in that case, the man who donates the sperm, but not through a regular donor organization, someone could come back and sue him for child support.
Sue for child support, or they can sue for visitation.
Right.
You can end up in multiple parent families that were not planned.
You have claims against an estate. The child has a right to inherit from that. If that person has no will, or if even if he has a will, there may be a claim that he mistook and didn't name the child along with his other children. So there are so many pitfalls for people with lower incomes or with bad insurance that cannot afford to go through and use the services of fertility clinics and medical doctors in order to have their families. The insurance issue is another problem that probably isn't going to be cleared up by marriage rights. Here in New Jersey, in order to have fertility treatments covered, there's once again a presumption that the woman who's seeking fertility treatment is a straight woman who has a male partner. And basically what has to happen is that you have to prove to your insurance company that you have tried for a period of time to become pregnant in the natural way, and you have been unsuccessful in becoming pregnant. Now, a lesbian couple has a hard time proving that because they haven't been able to prove that they were trying the old-fashioned way. Most lesbian couples do not have insurance coverage for artificial insemination.
Okay, let's back up. So let's say the lesbian couple, or, two gay men, are married. Now, it is my understanding that if one of them has insurance, that if that insurance through employment, what would you say as soon as someone is married, if one of them has insurance through employment, what would you say? Let's just limit it to the insurance for the adults for a minute.
Sure.
What would you tell them they have to do?
Well, once they're married, they can normally put their spouse on the insurance policy.
Have you run into any problems where, let's say in New Jersey, that when someone's married, because ordinarily, if it's a heterosexual couple, they'll just, let their insurance company know that they're now married.
Right. Well, I mean, the only problem remains, and it's going to continue to be an issue, is where your employer is a religious institution. And there, the issue is going to be, are they a church? And if they're a church, they're not going to be compelled to provide that.
So are you saying to me that a church that's an employer, if they insure a couple, a heterosexual couple, they can discriminate against an employee who's gay and say, we are not going to provide insurance?
Most likely. The issue becomes the gray area is where it is, for instance, a school that is religiously based, or a parochial school, but that admits children of all religions and hires people of all religions. Now you have a question about whether that is a public employer in the true sense, like it's a department store or a restaurant, or is it a religious employer, like the actual church would be. And these are issues that are going to continue to be debated, litigated, and there are some bright lines. There are some basic concepts that we understand of what the First Amendment means in terms of the free exercise of religion and the inability of government to tell religion what to do. But it's where religious institutions break out into the public arena where that gray area lives and where those debates are going to continue to be. Bill, you going
to? No, I wanted to actually move on to something else.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay. Because I think this is important information to get out to people who are listening. I get a lot of questions, as I'm sure Deb does. I have clients who got married 10 years ago in Canada, and they want to know, well, now do we have to get married in New Jersey? Do we need a New Jersey marriage? So the answer to that is no. Once you got married once in a place where it was legal, that counts. So you don't need to get remarried. Then we have the situation where people are in civil unions in New Jersey, and they think that they have all the rights of marriage. Well, they do under New Jersey law. But there's no federal recognition of a civil union, except in very limited circumstances, of a civil union by the federal government.
And I think this is really important because people move around. So I would like to spend a few minutes talking about what happens if someone has a civil union here in New Jersey, and then they go to a state where the state would have to, under the new case, grant them a marriage license, but what happens if that state does not recognize civil unions?
They have no recognizable relationship there.
Right.
And this creates a lot of problems because, as I tell people, you know, lawyers unfortunately sometimes just have to think in the worst case scenario.
We do.
We're kind of doomsayers, right? So, you know, you say to somebody listen, you have a civil union. Let's say you go down to Tennessee, which now has to allow same-sex couples to marry, but you stay in your civil union. And let's say one of you is very badly injured in a car accident. Well, the other one of you doesn't have the right to sue for damages. Right. Because you're not recognized as having a legal relationship to the person who is injured. And God forbid your partner or spouse is killed, your partner is killed, you do not have the right to sue for a wrongful death because you would not be a surviving spouse.
Well, let's even talk about, and I don't mean to jump ahead or jump around, but maybe I do, Social Security. What happens in a situation under a Social Security? We know that if two people are married and they've been married for 10 years, the spouse can, if they don't have enough Social Security in their own name, they can get Social Security under their spouse. What happens? I assume that there's no protection under a civil union. Am I wrong or right?
That's one of the areas where the federal government is recognizing civil unions.
Okay.
Because Social Security recognizes marriage, but then it says if you're not married, but under the laws of intestacy of your state where you are resident, that the survivor would collect from the estate as the survivor, then Social Security will recognize that person. So in a civil union, you could use that.
In New Jersey.
In New Jersey. In New
but
Jersey.
In Tennessee, if they don't recognize civil unions.
Correct.
I'm using Tennessee
right.
as an
no,
example.
No, right. Absolutely. You know, that this is kind of a holdover from the fact that the Social Security laws were created in the 1930s, where a great number of states recognized common law marriages. And so they had to figure out what happens if a common law spouse dies. Are we going to cut them out of a survivor benefit, or are we going to recognize that they had in their own home state a legal relationship?
Oh, so has that always been part of Social Security?
It has.
From the inception?
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
But that's interesting.
We've only morphed it over
right.
to civil unions, but it really was that language is written for common
for
law.
For common law.
Right.
That's
right.
Very interesting.
So it's been
it?
So it was kind of creative lawyering to recognize that. But again, that only in terms of civil unions, that only is if there's a death and you're looking for a survivor benefit. It has
right.
nothing to do with retirement benefits and being able to tack on to a partner to a partner's
well, that was my
retirement.
Question.
Yeah, so
you can't really
you
tack
can't.
On.
You can't. So in the example you gave, you've been married for more than 10 years. If the civil union couple dissolve their civil union, there's no step up like you'd get in a marriage.
What if they don't even? I mean, it seems to me even if they don't dissolve it, if
right, you don't get the step. You don't get the step up.
You don't get the step up.
Let me add another level of complexity to this. There are at least five or six states in the United States where they allowed people to go into civil unions, and then the legislature decided that they were going to transform all those civil unions into marriages.
So can they do that?
Well, they did it in Connecticut, Vermont, Rhode Island, Delaware, a couple of others. And so now I have clients who did a civil union in Connecticut, and now Connecticut says they're married, so they ask for a marriage certificate. Connecticut won't issue them a marriage certificate. They'll only issue them a civil union certificate with a note on the back that it's been transformed into a marriage. So those people said to me, well, what should we do? Should we get married? And I said, yes, you should get married.
Right.
You need to get married so you have a marriage certificate and you have something to show to Social Security because, you know, a note on the back of your civil union certificate doesn't work. So we're, you know, in the midst of all this transformation and change, and so there are a lot of open questions.
But at least it's an exciting time to be
dealing
with these
questions.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, on these issues, on these real hard, you know, on these kind of federal benefits issues and a lot of the economic issues, 10 or 15 years ago, they're not going to be here anymore. It'll all be ironed out. Everybody will know what their rights and obligations are, including the government, and a lot of these things will be resolved. Unlike the parentage issues that we've talked about, they may still be an issue quite some time into the future.
And we should really point out also that in New Jersey, there are three levels of legal relationship recognition. There's marriage. There's still civil unions for same-sex couples. That has
right.
not been done away with. And there's domestic partnership for couples where both partners are over the age of 62. And they each have different facets and features. And if a couple is thinking of trying to get legal recognition of their relationship, they have all three of those things to explore as which one works best for them.
And what I would say is anyone in that situation really needs to see someone like Deb or Bill, because honestly, most attorneys, even family law attorneys, and I consider myself a very experienced family law attorney, but I certainly wouldn't be able to tell a couple which is the better avenue for them, mm-hmm. and why one is better than the other in their particular circumstances. So once again, and I always tell my listeners that it's very important to talk to an attorney. We're not that scary. Most attorneys, you can pick up the phone, you can ask a couple questions. And as my listeners also know, I try to feature Hunterdon County attorneys because there are some great Hunterdon County attorneys. On the other hand, there's some specialties that you have to go to a specialist, and there probably are no, and I hope I'm not offending anyone, but I don't know of an attorney in Hunterdon County that would really be able to answer all of these questions.
And I have to say, Pat, I thank you for the really kind words that you sent towards me, and I'm sure towards Bill. But I will say that, you know, one of the great things about my practice, and I'm I hope I can speak for Bill on this too. I think I know I do, is that we learn something every day in representing gay and lesbian clients. We're part of, you know, large networks of attorneys around the country that share war stories and share developments. And literally every day there's something new happening somewhere in this country or in the world that we find out about. And it's been really an adventure to be able to work with clients who are thinking about moving or thinking about traveling, taking a job somewhere temporarily, and being able to pick up the phone and know that you've got a go-to person in another state or another country. And
you even hear the horror stories that some of us around the state, because we call you to say, wait a minute, what is our situation? what can these people do? And Deb has talked a couple times, and so has Bill, about traveling outside of the country. I cannot emphasize enough how important it is to know exactly what your rights are if you're traveling abroad. Not that I want to do war stories, but our first child was born in Guatemala. I had no right to take that child out of the country under the laws of Guatemala, and, you know, without my husband's permission, written permission. And so very early on, we got both a U.S. passport for this baby and a Guatemalan passport just in case, and we did all of the other things that we had to do in case something happened and he wasn't able to, take her out of the country. So, here we were, married, thinking there was no problem, and, there were lots of other funny stories about her being born there. But the point is, you have to be very aware of the laws in every country, and yet countries do recognize, and I think anyone who has a child, any lesbian, gay couple who has a child, better be sure that if they're traveling out of the country with that child, both parents are, in fact, the parents.
I agree, and I think it's even more important where the child is an adopted child and doesn't look like you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
The concerns about human trafficking are so high now, deservedly so, but people have been victimized essentially because of border patrols all over the world's concern about the movement of children out of their native countries to other countries. So the documentation and the paperwork that you have to protect yourself is essential.
And Deb, you're absolutely right. I remember when our daughter was young, if we crossed borders, even into Canada, we wouldn't, at that time, you didn't need to take a passport.
Yeah.
We always had to take hers because they would ask her, where were you born? And she'd very proudly say, Guatemala. And believe me, we'd have, or coming across the Mexican border, and we would travel a lot. So you're right. It is very important. And the human trafficking, that would be 10 more programs. But yeah. I hadn't thought about that as a reason. But it certainly I've traveled with children, and you're right. Anytime you're traveling with anyone else's children, but in this case, even when you're traveling with your own children. Yeah. But if your own children look a little different, you have to be careful, too.
And also, if a same-sex couple shows up at an airport, two women show up at an airport with a child, there might be issues of abduction or kidnapping, and where's the dad? And they have to want to be able to prove to whoever's asking these questions that they are the legal parents.
And they want to be able to do it in a way that doesn't embarrass the child.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, I mean, that's the other thing. You have to, you know, very discreetly perhaps show those passports and you know, so that this child isn't singled out as to why, because, you know, my two parents, why are they being taken out of the line? Why are they being asked questions?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So what else, Bill? I think you have a couple other things that
thing
we want
that
to talk about.
Come up, so there's been this development of different types of government recognition of our relationships and over time. And people have gotten a little lazy about understanding them or dealing with them. So Deb and I have both had situations where people showed up in our office and said, oh, you know, I was in a relationship with someone, and we went back in 2005. We went to Vermont and did a civil union, but I haven't seen her or him for 5 years, and now I want to get married. Does that matter? Well, of course it matters. You have to dissolve these prior relationships. So one very important... that all of this gets cleaned up. People, I think, you know, because the government didn't recognize the relationships, so people just ignored them or weren't as careful as they should be. When we had the Windsor decision 2 years ago, which said the federal government was now going to recognize marriages, we all of a sudden had people out there who were married who had not seen their spouses in years and were required to file joint tax returns. And so, you know,
or married filing separately.
Costing them much more money.
And which many of them didn't do.
Right, right.
Same thing with heterosexual couples. I mean, you'll say someone, and I've had cases where people have been separated for like 19 years.
Right,
and
right.
All of a sudden you say, well, you know, where is the spouse? And so you're right. Those are significant problems.
Or people who have, you know, been apart from whoever they married for years, and one of them dies. And you know what? There's a right to inherit whether they had a relationship or not.
Or if you had a child.
Yep.
Then your married spouse has rights to this child, even though you haven't seen that spouse for years.
Well, so, the interesting thing... Well, no, keep going, because I don't want to go that far afield.
No, but I, you know, Bill's absolutely right. You know, it's just been one of our great nightmares that's been growing for the past 20 years is that, you know, and it's well, actually, you know, like maybe what some civil union started in Vermont in 2001. So since that time, you know, there have been people who have done almost everything they can to try to protect themselves. One of the cases that was just heard by the Supreme Court, the couple had three marriages. They married in Canada and in Iowa and in California, all on this journey to try to have somebody recognize their marriage. And they ended up in Tennessee. This is the Kentucky couple. They end up in Kentucky, which won't recognize any of the three of them. So, you know, so it's very important. And you know, we see people all the time here who have both a marriage now and a civil union. They want to get divorced. You have to take care of the civil union as well. Nothing in New Jersey law merged those two two relationships.
So let's assume, and you know, first of all, I'd send the person to you most of the time. Not not any longer, perhaps, if it was simply a divorce.
Sure.
But that's very interesting, because I am going to assume that most attorneys would not be aware of the fact that if someone gets divorced, that the civil union is not dissolved at the same time.
You know,
is that really true?
Yeah, yeah. And part of the if you were in a domestic partnership.
Right.
And you entered into a civil union with that same partner, the law merged those relationships.
Right.
And it said the domestic partnership is dissolved. You're now in a civil union. But because our marriage equality came about by a court case, not by a statute, there's no mechanism to absorb the civil union into the marriage. And so if people are going to get divorced, they've got to terminate both relationships, because otherwise the civil union remains on the books of the state of New Jersey as a valid relationship.
Pat, let me throw out a question to you as a family lawyer. So let's say a couple was going into a civil union, and they did a pre-civil union agreement, similar to a prenup. and then 3 years later they get married. Is that prenup still valid, or has it been invalidated because of the subsequent marriage?
Well, I think you'd have to look at the prenup and see what it says, because if the prenup is simply a contract and it's very specific that they're entering into a civil union, mm-hmm. I would certainly tell this couple that you must do a subsequent or a new, whatever you want to call it. You'd have to do a premarital agreement. Yeah. Because you're now talking about an agreement that right. you're getting married. Very similar to, I will have people who do cohabitation agreements. Well, you know, they're not worth the paper they're written on
right.
if they subsequently get married. So I think absolutely the courts would say that in order to enforce a premarital agreement, they'd have to have a new one, don't you?
Right, I agree with you. But I do agree that there could be times when an agreement was written to say that where the parties agreed that if we can marry in the future, we want this agreement to remain binding.
Or they could say something in the agreement that irrespective of any change of law,
right,
or
right.
you know, right. then it continues in
right.
full force
but,
and effect.
But one of the biggest problems that gay couples have had is that many who have been together for a very long time did what they believed were prenup agreements, but they didn't comply with the statute.
Right.
They may not have fully disclosed their assets. They might not have had counsel and things like that that the courts really look at to see, and that the statute requires for it to be a binding agreement. So a lot of those agreements were informally reached or were reached before anybody thought we'd get to a point where marriage was really a possibility. And we were just trying to put together something that would hold together on a basis of what is fair.
Well, one question that I'd have, because I thought that there would be many more people seeking premarital agreements, and some people have told me that the reason that it hasn't happened is so many of the couples who are now getting married have been together for so many years, so that it's not a situation where, you know, they're just getting together, and so perhaps they're thinking about a premarital agreement. But if they didn't have some agreement years ago, they're just, you know, it's just not happening. Are you finding that you have a lot more interest in the premarital?
Before they could get married, some of them did, like different sex couples, said we're going to merge our fortunes together and be a couple. Others have been very much what's mine is mine and what yours is yours, and while we're together as this unmarried couple, you know, we can share in each other's benefits, but when we leave,
that's it.
And so I have done many prenups for couples like that who decided they were going to get married but wanted to maintain that separateness.
Yeah, and I think I've seen both things, Pat, and I think one of the confusions, another thing that I would love to be able to have gay and lesbian couples truly understand is that if you have lived your lives together relatively separate on an economic basis, you have to understand what the obligations of marriage are before you go into it. Because you can live as separate as you want when you're not married, but the moment you do get married, there's a lot of stuff that becomes joint. There's a lot of responsibilities that become legally binding that you may not have wanted there to be. And retirement assets are for one. So, yes, premarital retirement assets are separate property. What's yours is yours and mine is mine. But once we marry, unless we have an agreement, everything that I acquire while I'm married is going to be distributed if we divorce.
Well, I have an interesting dilemma right now. It isn't a gay or lesbian couple, but it is a heterosexual couple where one spouse was disabled before the marriage. Now there's a marriage. It's been a marriage of a few years. And the question is alimony.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that perhaps the question of alimony is even going to be more significant in these cases than the assets, because if they can prove certainly premarital assets are separate, but if they dissolve this marriage, what happens, especially if we're couples who perhaps are older when they marry, and one is disabled, one needs alimony. I mean, mm-hmm. there, and with our new alimony statute, it even makes it perhaps more of an issue.
Well, yeah, I mean, there were discussions about the new alimony statute and whether or not looking at couples who'd been together a long time but could not marry legally, but behaved like they were married. They took care of each other. They had a joint bank account. One stayed home to raise the kids, and one went out to work. And then there's a divorce, but they'd only been married a couple of years. Is that a 3-year marriage, or is it a 20-year marriage? Mm-hmm. This remains a problem, and it's still not that clear as it may be for different sex couples who had every opportunity to marry at any time they wanted to.
That you're right. That's an interesting. Well, and of course, in some of those cases where even heterosexual couples acquire property together, there's always the equitable issues that come in, mm-hmm. but make everything more complicated. So
right.
I guess you probably tell people the same thing I do, which is, you know, if you're young and you get married, you know, throw everything in the pot unless there's some really unusual mm-hmm. circumstances. But especially people who have children from other relationships, they really need to think about these financial things before they enter into marriage.
Absolutely.
Yeah. They marry later in life. And
marry later in life.
So I think it's also important that to recognize that a lot of employers provided domestic partnership benefits to people who could not get married. And now that marriage is available in all 50 states, a lot of those domestic partnership benefits are going away. And I have clients who are forced to decide, are we going to have health insurance, or are we going to get, and get married, or are we not going to? Or one of us is not going to have health insurance, and we're not going to get married, because the universities, large corporations, are doing away with domestic partnership benefits, which used to be there.
That's interesting. Now, are they notifying everyone who's been covered?
Oh yeah. No, people are getting notified. I just worked with a client just a couple of weeks ago who decided to go into a civil union. They weren't ready to get married, but we did a civil union. It was a New Jersey employer, and that's going to continue the benefit. But they had about 3 months' worth of notice. Frankly, I think it really should be a lot longer. I would hope that maybe the state will take a look at those kind of situations and provide more significant notice to people, but
some employers are even not giving those benefits to people in civil unions.
Yeah,
saying you have to be married,
right? Which in New Jersey that would be wrong,
mm-hmm.
Because a civil union remains a quote unquote marriage equivalent,
right?
Again, if it's a national employer with a very small number of people working here in New Jersey, they may not be bound by the New Jersey law.
Or you live in New Jersey but work in Pennsylvania or New York,
right?
The laws are different there. They don't have civil unions in New York or Pennsylvania, so they could say married or not, you know, your Pennsylvania employer.
Right. So I think if a couple is getting their insurance through an employer, they really need to stop by the benefits office or pick up the phone and say, what's the status? Are there any thoughts about changing this so that we can make appropriate plans?
And that is really significant, because for so many, people, mm-hmm. medical insurance is really important. Now, will the Affordable Health Care Act have any effect at all on these issues?
No, you know, eligibility for insurance is still going to be a state-by-state basis. The ACA really just, you know, mandates certain types of levels of coverage within an insurance plan. The Affordable Care Act has done some very good things in terms of affordability of care for transgender people. And hopefully we'll continue to expand upon that. But, you know, the access and the eligibility, is, if it's employer-based insurance, is still going to be something that, going forward, as it always was, is probably going to be marriage-based. And now that there's nothing barring same-sex couples from getting married, an employer who really cared and who really wanted to do the right thing can now simply say, look, you can get married. I'd be treating you differently and better now than your opposite sex counterparts if I gave you something that wasn't based on marriage but made them get married in order to access it.
That's a good point. And let's get back and go kind of around, not full circle perhaps, but back to the artificial insemination. I don't understand how insurance companies, maybe I do in light of what they will... pay for Viagra, but will not pay for birth control. But, in light of the fact that it would seem to me that it should be easier for the lesbian couple to be covered under, to have artificial insemination, in light of the fact that they can say, hey, we cannot unless we commit adultery, we cannot get pregnant.
Well,
I'm sorry, that's kind of a strange way of saying it, but it's true.
But you're right. But the problem is that, again, our insurance, the way the insurance law is looking at it is that they're looking at it by saying we have an obligation to treat a medical condition, not a social condition. So what they say is that we pay for fertility.